provision
of
the amendment on sex. Did you have...
During the coffee break, I lost all interest in sex. Temporarily. So I'd like to address myself to a different subject, if I may.
Well, you left us hanging on that one.
Oh, that's what's tantalizing about it. So, if I may, in the earlier discussions by the panel, quite a bit has been made, and justly so, of the native land rights. I'd like to address myself shortly to that. The Constitution neither mandated nor prohibited anything along those lines, obviously. So directly or indirectly, the mentioning of native land rights is not germane to the constitutional review. There is nothing pending, and the Constitution neither, as I said, mandated nor prohibited anything. The development is very nice in the line of general, not so much human rights as political developments. I like to look at it as a political and property situation. And my Swiss background has the ladies land rights quite a bit there, by the way, about that, because I have, and my children born in Alaska, land rights in Switzerland, now at this moment, corporate rights, the concept that my native friends understand very well, in fact, learned a bit from me, they will admit it. Now, but as a highlight to the temperament of the Constitutional Convention 20 years ago, we had a native delegate among 55, and we had a couple that had native wives. But for the rest, it was largely a Caucasian enterprise, that Constitutional Convention, which reflects the relative small role that the native community at that time played for a variety of reasons, not necessarily discrimination, but just their the very rural status that was prevailing, with a few exceptions. But an interesting thing comes to my mind in the discussion in the coffee break, that's what got me off of sex, is the fact that I made quite a spiel, probably at the wrong time and too early in the Constitution, and formulated, I think, a very beautiful resolution that in honor of the first inhabitants of Alaska, the first Americans in Alaska, our native friends, we should consider to change the name of Mount McKinley into Mount Denali. Obviously, I got Senator Pratovich's support, and a lot of raised eyebrows on various grounds, and it didn't pass. But to my great pleasure, the climate has changed. Now we have so many parlor liberals and even businessmen that have to come to the stand that it is not only fair, but even profitable to be nice to our native friends, that this proposition has come up again recently. And I hope also that it might come to pass. And not so much as a human right proposition, should McKinley's name be changed to Denali, but as a symbol of our changing attitude.
Thank you. I forgot to mention that I would like to ask everyone now that take the microphones and try to hold their remarks down to about 3 minutes, because we still do have a lot of ground to cover and not too much, only about 45 more minutes to cover it in. So just 1 minute, this is 30 minutes. I'd like to follow Jewel, who brought up the native rights situation and the fact that there were too many natives at the Constitutional Convention, and since Lee is being San Tito today, I would, for those of you who were not here earlier, Lee Gorsuch has filled in for both San Tito and C.R. Lewis, who was able to make it to the last minute, so we have quite a large area covered. But I'd like to ask him to just talk for a moment about what has been the evolution and what has happened in the 20 years since the convention. Do you think the fact that there were not a lot of native representation at the Constitutional Convention, did that in any way hurt the Constitution? And what has been the effect of anything that was in the Constitution or that was left out on the native situation? You mentioned earlier perhaps the Molly Lynch case that's been would you like to talk about that?
Well, I'll leave the Hooch case to the Attorney General, who is in the process of negotiating out-of-court settlement. which is contingent on the passage of the bond issue, which we'll all be voting on very soon. As far as the Native participation in the constitutional review and whether or not it reflects any appreciation for Alaska Natives, I think it's quite clear that the state constitution is neutral. It says absolutely nothing that recognizes Alaska Natives as the first and original inhabitants of the territory. Secondly, I think it's also a fair statement to say that if the constitutional convention were held today, that that would not happen, that there would be substantial references to the Native community with certain recognition of rights. If not rights, then certain privileges which would be bestowed upon the Native community in terms of things such as historical preservation, cultural preservation, and elements such as this. Partly, I think the what we've seen is that the whole civil rights movement in the United States culminated in the mid-1960s. In the late 1960s, we saw a transition into a national interest and concern with Native Americans, more so than urban blacks, which had been the minority group that we had been principally concerned with during the early parts of the 1960s. Today, we find a great deal of federal legislation which fosters a notion of cultural diversity, and we have numerous laws on the books which provide specific sources of funds for programs which foster as well as preserve cultural diversity in the various systems. For example, there's a potential constitutional issue that would face the Attorney General, I suspect, on the question of whether or not programs such as the Indian Education Act program, which provides federal funds specifically for the purposes of Indian children, and whether or not that creates a certain discrimination for the non-Indian children who may be a part of a particular school. It's an area that wouldn't necessarily affect the state vis-a-vis federal funds, but should the state use any kind of matching funds, it would be an issue that would have ramifications for the state constitution. I do think it has ramifications for the federal constitution, but it's an area that most people have preferred not to raise simply because we don't know what the outcome would be, and it does get very sticky, partly for the reason I mentioned earlier in terms of some American Indians have special relationships vis-a-vis treaties, others do not. The language in the treaties vary a great deal, and therefore uniformity in terms of the treatment of law is not the case. So I think it's been a matter of convenience that the United States Constitution has not been challenged, although I suspect that we may see some challenges in the relatively near future. But what it does is it recognizes, I think, on the part of the American people, an interest in maintaining a certain amount of cultural diversity. And they've attempted to do this primarily through enactment of various pieces of legislation, which are specifically aimed at providing various minority groups and different cultural groups a more active participation in the process of government and in the various public programs. I don't know, and I think it's a question that Alaskans have to face, as to whether or not Alaskans ought to be a participant in enacting legislation or appropriating funds which are specifically designed to maintain the cultural diversity of the state. We're now in a period of rapid economic change. There are some politicians who campaign on no growth, some campaign on balanced growth, and some campaign on accelerated growth. One thing is clear is that the composition of the state is going to be changing rapidly. Both the rural lifestyles are experiencing change, as well as the native lifestyles. I think it's a legitimate issue for the state to raise to itself as to whether or not it feels that through legislation or possibly even through constitutional amendment, there ought to be some effort to preserve a certain quality of life in Alaska that has some implications both for rural lifestyles as well as for native. The questions come up repeatedly in regards to subsistence, whether or not Native residents who have attributes of living off the land and a certain attachment to the land should be given any special privileges. The counter-arguments have been that it ought to be on the basis of economics. That is, if you need the food supply and you don't have enough cash to purchase it, then we could employ an economic means test, but we should not employ a test of ethnicity. And I think that's a case that raises a fairly fundamental question. It's of a constitutional nature, but it is one, I think, that we'll see legislation coming in the near future, and a great deal of pressure on the state side to try to develop some means of preserving those elements of the native culture that the state considers to be of value, not only for an economic sense in terms of attracting tourism, but also in the sense of maintaining a certain vitality that difference and adversity brings within the state. As far as the Molly Hooch case, as I said, I'd prefer to defer that to Av, since he's been the active participant on the state side negotiating the settlement.
Well, let me just say a brief word about the Hooch case. The major question before the courts in the Hooch case was whether or not an educational system in which urban students receive secondary education where they live and rural students who happen to be native have to go to boarding school to receive the same education provides Alaskans, all Alaskans, an equal opportunity. The statistics indicate that boarding school education has a rather different and significant impact on people than being able to go to school where you live. But the significant thing about the Hooch case, as far as I was concerned, was this. Too often, I think we look just to the courts to enforce civil rights. We assume that if anything goes wrong in our society, that the judges will fix it for us. Now, the problem with that is that it leads to situations in which we end up saying, why are the judges usurping all that power? They're usurping all that power because nobody else will do anything. Now, in the Hooch case, when I came into office, my attitude was that civil rights should be just as equally enforced by the legislative and the executive branches as they should be by the judicial branches. So we basically said, look, how can we resolve this case without having the judges tell us how to run our schools? We're basically saying, what do we need in the bush? How can we do something to make a meaningful educational opportunity for rural students, who for the most part have to be native, but nonetheless rural students? And therefore, the governor submitted, after we negotiated with the representatives of the rural community, submitted a bond package to the legislature, which would construct certain schools in rural districts. It was fascinating to me that after he did submit that bond issue, after the case had been in the courts for 4 years and nobody had done anything up to that point, there were a whole group of legislators that then came running in and said, why not more? But in any event, that I suppose is an inevitable consequence of politics. One way or another, the legislature adopted a bond issue, which will go before the voters this fall. And the voters will have a chance to vote directly on whether they're going to settle this case through the political process or whether they're going to leave it to the judiciary to tell us, you know, what will be required to give equal rights to people who live in bush communities. I hope they pass it. I really do, simply because it does represent a political judgment as to how this question is settled. And it really, it is a political decision. It's a decision that should be made by the legislature and the executive branches, not the courts. And I think it's the first time we've tried to do that, to resolve these civil rights through the legislative and executive process. And I think it's extremely healthy that we're doing it that way. And I hope it is resolved that way.
Mr. Byrne, you wanted to ask a question, and I cut you off.
My name is Carolyn Berg, and I'm a correspondent law student. And this morning, it was pointed out to me that this session was for the 55 Club, so therefore I'm going to read the general purpose of this meeting. Evaluation of Alaska's Constitution within the perspective of Alaska's experience as a state, trends and requirements for the future, and the 200 years of the United States federal system. Participants will include delegates to the 1955-56 Alaska Constitutional Convention, individuals concerned with public affairs, university faculty and students, and the general public. Now, I belong to individuals concerned with public affairs and the general public. So I just want to make that clear that the general purpose of this meeting is to include all of us, not just the 55 Club. Thank you. Now, I came here from Juneau especially to state that our sovereignty has been taken away from us, our people's sovereignty, through the 25th Amendment. And I wish to make this very clear because this is very important for each citizen to realize this. The 25th Amendment is completely unconstitutional and in conflict with Article 2, which says the president and vice president must be elected. It doesn't say they must be appointed. The second section of Article 2 in part states, but no senator or representative or other person in high trust shall be appointed an elector. An elector means a voter. When Congress introduced the 25th Amendment and Richard Nixon appointed Gerald Ford, they all appointed themselves electors. And the 25th Amendment is unconstitutional upon its face. So what we have in the state of Alaska now and in the United States is a United States amendment that is completely unconstitutional and is supposedly ratified by the state. Well, I claim this is not right because we the people, we the sovereign citizens, are the principal in this contract with our government. And we're still a principal because we're paying all these people to stay within the United States Constitution. And they have not done this. So you can't have a mutual contract unless you have the principal involved and knowing what has been done. So it is not so-called ratified, and we're challenging it. Now I want everyone to realize that right now, the President of the United States is not legally an officer of our country, and the Vice President is not legally an officer of our country. And Rockefeller knows about this because Article 2 was based on New York's Constitution of 1777, which says that the governor shall be elected by the people, not appointed by the legislature. So I want you all to realize I think this is a part of public responsibility.
Thank you.
My name is S.J. Buckley. I was a delegate from Anchorage. First off, Ev, I don't know whether in your example, when you started discussing grand jury, there's been, of course, that issue has been addressed as whether or not it should be abolished. But the grand jury system that we enjoy today in this state is substantially different than the grand jury system that existed when we were territories. You recall, prior to becoming a state, there was no discovery at all other than the names of the witnesses endorsed on the indictment. Of course, now the defense gets a transcript. The decisions have imposed additional duties upon the prosecutor. I think the decisions indicate that the prosecutor's role has been diluted. He's a combination advocate. At the same time, he has a duty to certain responsibilities to the accused. And I have mixed reservations about whether or not the grand jury system should be changed somewhat. I think we should maintain the system the grand jury for the purpose of investigation, so that if there's something wrong in the system, the grand jury can address that issue. But your example, that whether the grand jury could make a report to the court, then suggests that some public official had embezzled public funds, and that the judge would allow that to be published, I doubt if that had happened. I think if the presiding judge took a report from the foreman of the grand jury and it, in effect, charged the citizen with a crime like embezzlement, and just made general allegations, I doubt if the court would let that report be published. I think what the judge would do would send the grand jury back and point out the particular section and tell them to reconsider it and either indict him or forget it. That's the way I think that would happen. I doubt if that situation really would happen in this jurisdiction. I hope it would, and I don't think I would publish such a report if I was taking the report.
Could you stop it? I mean, could you actually prohibit
it? It might put the judge on the hot, it might may put him in a very heated atmosphere, but I think that the judge would probably tell the grand jury, well, you're going to have to consider this as a crime and this is the statute, and I think the judge would have a duty to advise the grand jury that there's no way the citizen could answer these charges. And I think it flies in the face of the presumption of innocence and all the other fundamental rights that we have. And I just don't believe that it could happen, but I don't think it would. And this one gentleman, I enjoyed his remarks, but I don't know that this not proved verdict would help in our situation or not. I think most Americans accept the philosophy that a person is innocent until he's proven guilty. I think they understand this presumption. I think they understand that presumption runs throughout the trial and it's not overcome until the jury reaches a verdict. And if there's a hung jury, then he still has a presumption of innocence. So even if it's a hung jury, the state doesn't re-prosecute. Theoretically, he should still have that presumption. People should assume that he is in fact innocent. It's a matter of law, he is, and until a jury says that we're convinced, 12 of us, beyond a reasonable doubt. And I don't know. I think it'd be awful hard to improve on that system, and I would be reluctant to even tamper with it. And as I see, I've observed criminal prosecutions over a period of more than 25 years, and I think that the quality of justice in this state is probably superior to any of the other states. And when we talk about the rights of the accused, I know the whole system is under assault. Maybe certain people get the idea that the ills of society can be settled or solved by a judge, in most instances, giving the maximum sentence. We all know that we have problems in our society and that the judicial system is not going to be able to cure all these evils in imposition of the sentence because there's too many factors involved. But, a man has no funds. The public defender agency resources are equal to the prosecutor's resources. So really, I can't really see that a native or whites or blacks are really treated differently in the judicial system. And then, of course, you have the judicial council, and they keep book on everything the judge does. If you sentence so many natives, those sentences are reviewed somewhere along the line. You sentence so many Caucasians, and they correlate this. And I think most of the judges are aware of the fact that every effort must be made to ensure a system that affords equal rights to all the citizens. And some of these problems we're talking about with the natives and so forth, I don't know how you could handle that in a constitution, because theoretically, in this system of government, the basic fundamental test is citizenship. And if a man is an American citizen, he's a citizen of the state of Alaska, then that's it. His right should be the same as all the other citizens. So it looks to me like we're getting a, if citizenship is a test, then there's no way the judicial system could treat one citizen different because of his ethnic background or any other question, because the test is, if he's a citizen, then the rights flow with the citizenship. But I don't know, I'm satisfied. And it's kind of self-serving. I'm sorry that Ewell Kilcher is gone, because you'd think that Ewell did have some participation in the martial law provision that's found in the executive, but there were 55 other delegates there. And as I recall, some of the lawyers were aware of the ex parte Milligan and the fact that in the Civil War, the federal court said that the citizen had a right to a writ of habeas corpus, and the Confederate soldiers had to be on the steps of the courthouse with fixed bayonets and keeping the litigants out of the courthouse. Otherwise, that court was open. So I'll admit, Ewell did help on that article, but I look around here and see other delegates that I recall participated in those discussions, including Dorothy Aws. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge Buckley. And you have really kicked off of what I would regard as about the final 20, 25 minutes of this session. I know that some of us have to leave shortly. What I think I understand you to be saying is that human rights and justice in Alaska after 20 years is in pretty good shape. And I'd like to know really whether the panel, I'd like to throw it back to the panel right now and see whether that's your conclusion of where we are after this discussion, that one, has the Constitution that worked pretty well? Two, do we need another constitutional convention? And three, what is the thrust for the future? If you take exception to Judge Buckle's information that things are in pretty good shape, I'd like you to know why. Lisa, I'd like to throw it to you first, because I know you have an airplane.
Oh, thank you. I think I can answer the question as to whether or not the Constitution works well by just simply saying we're here, we're still a going concern in Alaska, and we haven't had to amend our Constitution terribly, and we've been able to deal with all kinds of problems and situations that were probably not conceived by the delegates, because Dorothy says they haven't got to radar yet. In Alaska at that time, we've been able to deal with situations that were not dreamed of at the time the Constitution was written within the framework of that Constitution. I'm very proud of the Alaska Constitution. I think it's a wonderful document. I'd like to just, in thinking in terms of the future, follow up on what Judge Buckaroo and Lee Gorsuch said in connection with the preservation of cultural diversity, or some kind of acknowledgement or recognition of cultural diversity, the possibility of it, and just maybe throw some thoughts out on that. Particularly in the light of what most of us are concerned about, and that is subsistence hunting. Subsistence hunting seems to be a focus for a great deal of concern over whether or not Native people in the state are going to be able to preserve the way of life which they traditionally had. And I would submit that the question is fast becoming moot because of some very recent developments, and that is that I think we've all read about the tremendous decline in the Arctic caribou herd recently, to the point where the Board of Game has had to impose limits on the taking of game in that herd, whereas limits had not been imposed in the past. Now, whether or not we recognize the desirability of allowing subsistence hunting in the state to people whose culture depends on it, we are going to have to recognize that we don't have the game anymore to support that kind of activity. even if we allow it only for subsistence use, we're going to run into the situation where the native population is increasing and the herds are decreasing, and we're going to have to limit the amount of game that is taken even by subsistence hunters. Now, as to whether or not it would be possible to preserve a culture by supporting certain elements of that culture or encouraging certain elements of that culture, I'm inclined to think we probably can't, because a culture is a fabric of so many spontaneous elements that when one thread of it is pulled out, it becomes weakened considerably, and it's very difficult to weave that thread back into a culture once it's been pulled out. I think we are hesitantly to take on this sticky subject because it is sticky, because it's very, I can't imagine being able legislatively or even constitutionally to preserve a culture. We can institute programs which intend to encourage a culture to preserve itself, but it's very, very difficult to think in terms of legislatively or constitutionally preserving a culture, especially in view of the fact that, as I said, at least in this area, I'm afraid the question is going to be moved very soon. With increasing native population and decreasing herds, I'm afraid we're going to have to impose limits even on the fishing. Having said that, I will say that I supported in the legislature this year a bill which allows the Board of Game to set aside subsistence hunting areas, having had hearings in the areas where no hunting or fishing activity would be allowed except for subsistence hunting and fishing. And I'm not sure whether that passes in the now law or not, but if it isn't, maybe we'll go at it again next year, because I think it's an option that should be open to the state to allow subsistence hunting only in certain areas.
Thank you. Jack,
well, if you want to go through the panel, you've still got a half hour. You follow through your train from them. I'd like to keep it open for
general discussion. I'd like to try to keep us in the framework, if we may, right now, of the three questions that we posed. So it has the Constitution work. Do we need another constitutional convention, and what's the threat for the future? We've talked quite a bit about what happened in the past. Now I'd like to look at.
Well, I think that the answer is academic on all three of them, and basically that no, I don't think that we need another constitutional convention, because I don't think that we've been cluttered with enough amendments to the point where that we've misdirected the basic concern that the delegates had in 1955. I think that if you had another constitutional convention, you would open it up to contemporary situations, and you'd find that your document would be about 50 times what it is now, because there's a very definite division between constitutional law and legislative law. And I leave that up to the judge or to the attorneys. But as to the way it has worked, yes, I think that it's worked very well in the last 20 years. But I think that, like everything else that's humanly made, that there are some provisions in here that we need to really strengthen up. And I think that in the educational article where we turned the university completely loose from the administrative branch and from the legislative branches, one of the areas that needs to be strengthened up, that needs to be brought back into line, and I think that we have the vehicle within the legislature, within the Constitution, to do it through legislative law. I was quite interested in some of the comments on the subsistence hunting and the case that you've got going with the Attorney General right now. And I think that the Constitution provides for this, and I think that where the fault lies is not in the framing of the Constitution, but in the effectiveness of the legislative enactments and the legislative thinking as they try to pose a solution to a subject. And I think that we as humans weave these beautiful webs just like the spiders do, and the next thing you know, we're caught up in them. Possibly one of the areas that we should have looked at is that we should have had a legislative review every 10 years of the statutes, a constitutional provision. And I think that this is one of the areas that we argued about a little bit on the legislative side, but I think that it would have really had some effect in it. on the human rights area where we are now, I think that one of the areas that we fail to address ourselves to is to big government, is to the fact that government has become the thing now. Government has become the focal point of business life and private life, where when we wrote the Constitution, the individual's rights were the focal point. And I don't think that we wrote in enough to prohibit rules and regulations by inference that the legislature has lazily bestowed upon some agency. You have read many, many statutes where it says, goes down and has about five or six different points, and it says, and the Department of Administration shall implement this act by writing rules and regulations, and they turn the complete legislative process over to a bunch of bureaucrats. And I think that the quiet revolution that's going on in the nation today and in the state is that the fact is that the executive branch, the constitutional three branches of government, are not the ones that are running government today. It's the bureaucracy that has, by legislative act, has got itself a cone around it where that the general public can no longer get to it. And when they write regulations and they impose mandatory fines on you, that actually that this is a part of the human rights, the Declaration of Rights, that we were weak in. We should have said in here that no law should be passed where that delegated the authority over to an agency that infringed or imposed a position against an individual because of an act of misdeed. And I'll close by saying, you know, you get up in the morning and you put your little pinkies on the floor and you've already broke some rule or some regulation by some self-serving agency somewhere down the line. And this is what we have to address ourselves to as far as the Constitution through better legislation. Thank you.
Thank you. Do any of the panel want to answer that?
Well, I'll just say briefly that the problem, of course, that Darko talks about, I think, may not lie so much in the Constitution as it may lie in better legislation, better legislative acts. Government is more complex today. There's any question about it. There's more problems to deal with, and the legislature is already overburdened. I mean, it's not so much as criticism as a recognition of the problem. It's difficult for the legislature to deal with these things on a day-to-day basis, so they tend to grant more and more authority to the executive branch, which now is comprised less of the governor and the cabinet as it is, just an enormous number of employees down there in other states that make a lot of rules. I just wanted to mention a couple of points on some other things that were said. On the native rights, I think you should all realize it's called a constant problem. Because people say the federal government treats Native differently than whites, why can't the state? The problem is that the Constitution of the United States gives Congress specific power to deal with Native groups in particular ways. But it also says, the same Constitution, that the state shall grant to citizens equal protection of the laws, which means that what Congress may do, we may not. We are prohibited by federal law from granting special privileges to any racial group, Native or what. In response to Kay's question as to whether the Constitution has worked, where we go from here, I think it's worked very well. I think particularly the Human Rights Article has worked very well. And I think that it's been amended as it's needed to be amended. In 1970, you probably will remember, we had a vote on whether or not to have a constitutional convention, and it passed. And some smart aleck lawyer down in Juneau brought a suit to throw out the vote because the ballot language was improperly worded, and the court went along. And so we had another vote on it, and the people voted not to hold one. I was very concerned at that time, quite frankly, that I was very leery about seeing a constitutional convention at that period in our history. I thought in 1970, we were in the midst of the terrible reaction that occurred against some of the U.S. Supreme Court decisions, reapportionment, there were riots going on the campuses across the country. I think some of our civil liberties were being pushed to the absolute extreme, and there was a lot of reaction to that. I was extremely leery about seeing a constitutional convention held at that point, because I had a feeling that in the temper of the times, when everybody was angry and upset and one thing or another, and we all were in one way or another, that the document might be destroyed. I don't have those fears anymore. I really don't. I think that whereas we don't necessarily need a constitutional convention, I certainly wouldn't be afraid of one. I think that the times are calmer. I think people would tend to examine our things from a more standoffish viewpoint, and I'm not afraid of what would happen in a constitutional convention anymore. Maybe my fears were misplaced at that time, but I think that today I'm certainly not concerned. And I think we probably will have one within the next probably 5 to 10 years, and I think that that's probably happening.
Thank you very much.
We're down now to the last 5 minutes or
minutes, so I would ask everyone to be somewhat brief in what they have to say.
I'd like to make a brief comment, if I could, please, that in this matter of health, education, and welfare, I'm a section of the University of Alaska. There was no papers that were drawn up by legislative committees or anything like that. There were backup papers as we had for many other areas. This was practically taken out of old law and placed in here. I would think that if you have a constitutional convention in 10 years, and I would hope you would too, that there would be some real thought given to this by research, as the university grows and will continue to grow, as to whether this is the best way to administer a state university system within Alaska. There are provisions in here on property that shall be administered and disposed of according to law. The regents, I think it's important that they have to be subject to confirmation by a majority of the members of the legislature in joint session. I'm speaking to the caliber of people who are appointed, and I take it that we're saying that it's not to be just a political plum, but that we have to take into account those who are really appointed as being responsible people. And the board shall, in accordance with law, formulate policy and appoint the president of the university. I think that all of these things we need to examine. In the state of New Mexico, there are regents for each one of the main campuses. I don't know how they arrived at that, but I don't think we ever anticipated the growth of a statewide system as it has occurred. And I'm not saying this other than in a very positive way. I think if you review something, remember this did not have the study and the backup papers that other matters had within the Constitution.
Thank you. You had something, Dorothy, that you wanted to add, and as our delegate to the convention to kick this off, I think it's appropriate to give some summation here.
Yeah, I don't have a lot of comments to make. I agree pretty much with the last few speakers that have spoken, Mr. Armstrong and Mr. Rudd and Gav. I did want to, before I'm doing this, perhaps adding some comments that Adam and Steve have been saying anything different. I agree with Ed's thoughts of the Constitution Convention. I don't think we need one now. But I think when we decide whether we need one or not, there's one thing that we should consider. As Jack Cogswell pointed out earlier, one reason why we have the Constitution we have is because people really didn't take it all that seriously, and we were able to put them in another academic background and theorize and come out with what we thought was the ideal thing to do. And we will never have a constitutional convention like that now, because we have more lobbyists than we need room for. It was one problem. And I agree that things have settled down. We don't have to fear and anger that we had a few years ago, but I think we are still in a state of transition where we're sort of testing and judging and reevaluating everything, not only in our government, but in our moral standards and everything. And I think right now, Constitutional Convention might have temporary provisions that are would reflect these problems, whereas I think it's shown, been shown that our Constitution is flexible enough to work through these problems as it is. And I think the reader continue to work with this Constitution and see if it will continue to do so. One other thing that Lisa said, and I thought I'd like to comment on, as far as Leah and Lisa both are talking about, the natives, and I think one of the things that's going to influence the natives as much as anything, and that is the fact that the natives have always been somewhat migratory people that follow the game and follow the fish. And the native land things are giving them thousands of acres of land. Is going to tie them to one spot. And I think that, as much as anything, is going to change the lives of the natives and perhaps even their whole culture. And I think we don't yet know how much that is going to do to the Sanhan.
Thank you very much, Dorothy. I think with that we're going to close this session. it would appear, if I could just very briefly summarize what we've talked about here, that most of you, both on the panel and in the audience, feel that the Constitution in the area of human rights has succeeded. That there are, even though there have been some very new problems that have come up, and particularly the whole area of the progress of natives and the question of native subsistence and culture is a whole new area for the next 20 years, perhaps, that perhaps we don't need another constitutional convention. Some of us are afraid that if there was one, that the lobbyists would descend and that we might possibly destroy what we already have, but others who don't fear have, so he doesn't fear another convention, so that we don't need one, but we could have one. And that the two areas that seem to have come up that need attention are the area of the native culture system, and perhaps the University of Alaska, which is several of you have expressed concern. With that, I hope that we can...
Madam Chairman?
Yes.
Could we use just a little bit of the remaining time? I have a question that I'd like to address to the original delegate for interpretation of what they intended when they wrote this time.
All right, if you make it a short question, yes. Please.
In Section 3, of Article 8, it deals with constitutional convention. It says, if during any 10-year period a constitutional convention has not been held, the lieutenant governor shall place on the ballot for the next general election the question, shall there be a constitutional convention? If a majority of the votes cast on the question are in the negative, the question need not be placed on the ballot until the end of the next 10-year period. Now, 2 years ago, I addressed this question to the then lieutenant governor, and he interpreted, or his staff interpreted this to mean that lieutenant governor shall not place the question on the ballot until the end of the next 10-year period. The Constitution here says the question need not be placed on the ballot. It gives the lieutenant governor the choice, the way I read it, as to whether or not he shall place the question on the ballot. Now, I would like to know from the delegates present if they have any recollection. Is my interpretation correct, or is the interpretation of the then lieutenant governor's office 2 years ago correct? Is it that the shall not place it on the ballot for 2 years, for 10 years after a negative vote, or that he need not?
Thank you. Dorothy, could you answer that,
please? I don't know if I recollect correctly, but I think you should read Section 2 and Section 3 in conjunction. Section 2 says the legislature may call constitutional convention at any time. And then Section 3 follows, however, for 10 years they don't do it, then the lieutenant governor shall place the ballot on the next general election, shall it be a constitutional convention. And I think it was intended that if the people say no, then he will not do it for another 10 years. If in the meantime somebody feels that that there should be a constitutional convention, then it's up to the legislature to put it on the ballot or to call it.
Thank you. We have 2 minutes left on our reel of tape here. Somebody within that 2 minutes, one of the other delegates, have any other thought about that particular question?
I would concur with that.
Second.